Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Tzvi Grummet discusses Toldot. Rabbi Grummet is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Tzvi Grummet.
Parashat Toldot opens with the story of Yitzchak and Rivka, Isaac and Rebekah, the childless couple. Isaac prays on behalf of Rebekah, and she becomes pregnant. Her pregnancy, however, seems troubled. Vayidrotzetzu habanim bikirba. The children ran about, as some would say. The children banged about, as others might say. She says, Im kein lama ze anochi? If this is going to be what my pregnancy is, then why am I? Vatelech. So she goes, lidrosh et Hashem. She goes to ask of God, to inquire of God. Where she goes, we don't know. But what is interesting is God's response. Vayomer Hashem la, God says to her, Shnei goyim bevitnech, u'shnei l'umim, mimeayich iparedu. There are two nations in your belly. Two peoples will separate from your womb. U'la'om mila'om ye'ematz. And one nation will be stronger than the other. Verav ya'avod tza'ir. Our discussion today is going to focus on these last three words. Rav ya'avod tza'ir. Most translations translate it as the elder shall serve the younger. Of course, Rebekah understood it that way, which is why Rebekah later on, we're told, favors Jacob over Esau, while Isaac prefers, later on, she arranges for Jacob to get the blessing from Isaac when Isaac is aging, despite the fact that Isaac intended for that blessing to go to Esau, which means that we have over here some form of prophecy that Rebekah receives, and because she understands that prophecy to mean that the younger shall serve the elder, and therefore that Jacob is the preferred child, she pushes Jacob into a situation in which, into a compromising situation, in which Jacob lies to his father, deceives him, and steals the blessing from his brother. That is the sequence of events that unfolds in the course of the parasha. The question is it possible to read those three words, Rav Ya'avod Tza'ir, differently? Again, the popular translation is the elder shall serve the younger. Here's the problem. The word Tza'ir appears in many places in the Chumash. It always means the younger. Its counterpart, however, is never Rav. The word Rav is never used as the counterpart to Tza'ir. The counterpart to Tza'ir is always Bechor. For example, when Jacob comes to Laban's house and he wants to marry Rachel, and instead there's a switch and he gets Leah. Well, he wakes up in the morning and he complains to Laban, I worked for 7 years for Rachel. Laban's response is, we don't do that in our place. Latet ha-bechira lifnei ha-tzi'ira, to place the elder before the younger. In the Bible, the counterpart for the younger is always the bechira or the bechor. There are a number of other places in the Bible where we see that as well. Lot, Abraham's nephew, for example, also has two daughters. The elder is called the Bechira, the elder. The younger is called the Tzi'ira. In fact, Rav, in the Bible, is never used to describe the elder. It's used to describe something that's large, numerous, powerful, never used to describe the elder. Which then raises for us an interesting question. So what does this mean? V'rav ya'avod tza'ir. If Rav does not mean elder, then what could it mean? Well, it turns out that there are other explanations for the word Rav. For example, Chizkuni, a classic medieval commentary, Chizkuni explains that the word Rav comes from the word harbei, much, in which case, when we read this text, it turns out that the text says, V'rav ya'avod tza'ir, that the younger will toil greatly. That's a very different meaning than the elder shall serve the younger. What it means is that the younger will have a very difficult life. The younger is going to work very hard. For the elder, things will come much more easily. This actually, in fact, is reflected in a passage that we recite in the Haggadah that actually comes from the book of Joshua. In the book of Joshua, chapter 24, towards the end of his life, Joshua gathers together the elders and then speaks to them. He describes a little bit of the history. The history is, God says, I took your fathers from the other side of the river, Terach, Abraham's father, they were idolaters. I took Abraham, I brought him from the other side of the river, I brought him through the land of Canaan, I made his children numerous, then I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau, I gave the land of Seir, and he settled in there. But Jacob and his sons, by contrast, went down to Egypt. And there in Egypt they toiled for many, many years, and then we all know the continuation of the story. What's the relevance of that text for our three words, V'rav Ya'avod Seir? Well, it turns out that the elder gets things fairly easily. In this case, Esau gets his land in Seir. He sets up a nation. He merges with the nation of Edom, as we're told later on in the book of Genesis. And by the time Jacob returns from his long exodus in Laban's house, Esau is already the father of a nation. Esav Avi Edom. He's called the father of the nation of Edom. Jacob is the father of a family. Esau is the father of a nation. He gets his nation and he gets his land rather quickly. But the younger has to work really hard. Jacob has to flee home. Jacob has to go toil in the house of Laban for 20 years as Laban keeps switching his salary. He has to come back. He has a very hard life. He says that to Pharaoh in Egypt much later on. Ma'at v'ra'im hayu yemei shnei chayai. The days of my life were few and very, very difficult. It turns out that if that's the case, then the younger indeed has a difficult life, and that the elder need not serve the younger. Now, I understand that some people are uncomfortable with this, because it says the tzair, and they therefore assume that the rav refers to the counterpart, to the elder, even though it doesn't mean that anywhere else in the Bible. It turns out that some of the other commentaries, ranging from the medieval grammarian, the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, all the way up until the pre-modern Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who, by the way, was not from Berlin, he was from Volozhin. He wrote a very fascinating commentary on the Bible. They both point out that there's an anomaly in the way this phrase is written. They take the word Rav to mean the elder, despite the fact that it doesn't mean that anywhere else in the Bible. With that, however, V'rav Ya'avod Seir, they point out that there's an important tiny little word that's missing. It should say, V'rav Ya'avod Et Seir. That's the definite article, that the elder will serve the younger. It points the direction of the way the serving goes. Radak, however, points out, and this is echoed hundreds of years later by Netziv, by Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, that V'rav Ya'avod Seir could easily be read the other way around, that the elder, comma, the younger shall serve. Now, when we put all of this together, what we have is a really fascinating phenomena. We have here some form of a prophecy that is given over to Rebekah. The prophecy is understood popularly as the elder shall serve the younger. And yet, the word Rav doesn't mean elder. And even if you want to say that the word Rav does mean elder, the missing definite article of et suggests the possibility, the very real possibility, that what it means is that the elder shall be served by the younger. In which case, we have a fascinating text in front of us. This text says that there is some kind of a prophecy that Rebekah receives. She interprets the prophecy one way, and she acts based on the way she interprets that prophecy. In fact, it could be argued that what Rebecca has received is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's because she interpreted the prophecy one way, that and she decided to act upon it as a result of the fact that she understood that God was telling her that the younger was the preferred one. Because of that, she set into motion a sequence of events, in which case it turns out that the younger one receives the blessing from his father, with some catastrophic result as in the process. What would have been, and we can only speculate, what would have been if she understood the prophecy like the Chizkuni did? Or if she understood the prophecy like Radak did? If she understood that Rav doesn't mean elder, Rav means a lot, that the younger shall work a lot. We don't know what would have been. We can only speculate what would have been. But it turns out that what we have is a self-fulfilling prophecy of Rebecca. That should not surprise us so much. It turns out that there are a number of other prophecies in the book of Genesis that could also be understood as self-fulfilling prophecies, or as prophecies that are subject to the interpretation of the prophet. Let's take, for example, one of the earliest prophecies where God tells Abraham, Lech lecha, go forth. Lech lecha me'artzecha mimoladetecha umibet avicha el ha'aretz asher areka. Go forth from artzecha, moladetecha, and beit avicha, which we don't need to define right now, and go forth to the land which I will show you. That's interesting. God does not specify to Abraham where to go to. He simply lets him know that he will let him know. Well, if we were to search through the entire Abraham story, Parsha of Lech Lecha, Vayera, and Chayei Sarah, from chapters 12 until 22 and even further, we will not find any place where God tells Abraham, this is the land that I told you to go to. What is Abraham to do? Well, it turns out that Abraham starts traveling in a particular direction. He reaches the land of Canaan. God does reveal himself to Abraham in the land of Canaan, in Shechem. Yet even after God reveals himself to Abraham and tells him that his children will get that land, Abraham continues traveling. He continues traveling southward. Clearly, Abraham didn't think that what God was telling him was that this was the place that he was supposed to go to. Vayisa Avram haloch v'nasoa hanegba. Abraham continues traveling southward. In fact, he travels so far southward, there's a famine that gets involved as well, but he travels so far southward that he ends up in Egypt. And when he gets to Egypt, he says, uh-oh, I think I've gone too far. When he finally extricates himself from the mess he got himself into in Egypt, there's a very strange pasuk. The verse says that Abraham, traveling, Vayelech lemasa'av, he went according to his travels. What does that mean, he went according to his travels? Apparently it means that he retraced his steps from the Negev all the way back to Beit El, from the south, going all the way back to Beit El, even north of Jerusalem, until he gets to the place where he had once pitched his tent. In that place, Abraham had looked around, pitched his tent, built an altar to God, and called out to God, but got no response. It was only after going to Egypt that he realized that he had passed the place that God had intended for him to go, and then retraces his steps to go back to that place afterwards. Abraham took him a long time, but Abraham learned to interpret God's signals. God said, I will show you the land. God, in fact, did show Abraham the land, but Abraham didn't realize that God was showing him the land. We have, then, a communication from God to Abraham in which Abraham needs to interpret. In the beginning, it's hard for him to interpret. That interpretation, Abraham misreads, ends up in Egypt, and has to retrace his steps. Fortunately for Abraham, and fortunately for us, later on in life, he actually learns how to interpret God's signals. Because there's another Lech Lecha in chapter 22, in the beginning of the story of Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, where God again tells him, Lech lecha el eretz hamoriah, go forth to the land of Moriah, v'ha'aleu sham le'ola, bring him up there for the offering, alachat ha'arim asher omar elecha, on one of the mountains which I will show you, or which I will tell you. Search through the entire text of chapter 22. Search through the entire story of the binding of Isaac, and nowhere you will find that God tells Abraham, this is the place. Rather, what we see, just two psukim later, Bayom HaShilishi, on the third day, Vayisa Avraham et Einav, Abraham raises his eyes, Vayar et Hamakom Merachok. He sees the place from a distance. God didn't show it to him, but Abraham sees it. Abraham has learned to interpret God's ambiguous messages. Rebecca also was given an ambiguous message. She interpreted it one particular way. We know the results of the way Rebecca interpreted that. It turns out that there are other places in the book of Genesis, and probably in the rest of the Bible as well, where we have people interpreting God's prophecies. Sometimes they get it right. But do they always? The Talmud, Masechet Brachot, on page 55 and 56, has a very, very long discussion about dreams. Dreams, the Talmud says, are 1/60th of prophecy. The Talmud also says that dreams always follow their interpretation. There's a rather graphic description of two Amoraim, two Talmudic sages, Abaye and Rava, both of whom had dreams, went to a dream interpreter to interpret their dreams. Abaye paid this dream interpreter handsomely, and this dream interpreter interpreted Abaye's dreams in very positive kinds of ways. And in fact, good things happened to Abaye. But Rava did not pay the dream interpreter. Dream interpreter interpreted Rava's dreams in negative ways. Bad things started happening to Rava. Very bad things. After a long period of time, Rava decided to pay the dream interpreter. And the dream interpreter started to interpret Rava's dreams in positive ways. You can imagine Rava's response to this dream interpreter when he discovered that this man had been making Rava's life miserable for a long time only because Rava did not pay him. There is one other fascinating prophecy which appears at the end of the book of Genesis. Some would argue that it is a blessing as opposed to a prophecy. Either way, Jacob, upon his deathbed, calls in his children and blesses them. Well, hard to call a blessing because not all of them sound so good. He calls in Shimon and Levi. We remember Shimon and Levi. They're the ones who deceived their father and deceived the people of Shechem and massacred the city of Shechem after the prince of that city had taken their sister Dinah and raped her and kept her. What does Jacob say to Shimon and Levi on his deathbed? Shimon v'Levi achim, besodam al tavo nafshi. My soul is not part of their secret. Bikhalam al techad kivodi. I don't want my honor to be associated with them in any way. Kiva apam hargu ish uvirtzonam ikushor, and then he curses them. Arur apam ki az, let their rage be cursed because it is too fierce. Ve'evratam, and their anger ki kashata, let it be cursed because it is tough. Achalakem bi'Yaakov va'afitzeim bi'Yisrael. I will split them up in Jacob, and I will scatter them amongst Israel. That to me sounds like a curse. Arur apam. In fact, if we take a look later on in the Bible, both in Sefer Bamidbar and Sefer Devarim, and even beyond, we discover that the tribe of Shimon actually disappears fairly quickly. They are the first tribe to disappear from amongst the Jewish people in the Bible. What happened to them? Basically, they were given a portion of land that was surrounded on all sides by Judah, and they got swallowed up into the tribe of Judah. By the time we hit the end of the book of Shoftim, the end of the book of Judges, we don't hear much from the tribe of Shimon anymore. In fact, Moses, who also blesses the people on his deathbed. Moses gives blessings to 12 tribes, but does not include Shimon. Shimon is left out of Moses' blessing at the end of his life. Apparently, Jacob's blessing, or Jacob's curse, had a profound impact on Shimon, and they are the first to disappear from the Jewish people. What about Levi? Well, Levi happens to be a tribe that later on in the book of Exodus is pushed to tremendous prominence, both because both Moses and Aaron are descendants of Levi, and because at the story of the golden calf, the tribe of Levi rises to the occasion to defend the honor of God. Turns out that Levi is moved into a position of prominence when the Mishkan, the tabernacle, is eventually built. They camp surrounding the Mishkan, surrounding the tabernacle. They are the closest to it. And Levi gets special treatment throughout the rest of the Bible, and in fact, the rest of Jewish history. What happened to Jacob's curse? Turns out that Levi takes Jacob's curse and transforms it into a blessing. They are set aside from the rest of the house of Jacob. It's exactly what Jacob says. And yet, set aside in Shimon's case means they are set aside and swallowed up. And in Levi's case means that they are set aside and put in a tremendous place of distinction. Shimon, the tribe of Shimon, is swallowed up in Judah. The tribe of Levi is scattered all over the nation. They are seated throughout the country. They form little cores. According to the Rambam, according to Maimonides, they become the teachers of the Jewish people. The tribe of Levi is scattered throughout the nation so that they have influence on people all over the place. A prophecy from Jacob, a blessing from Jacob, interpreted one way by Shimon, leading to his disappearance, and interpreted completely differently by Levi, leading to his rise to prominence. Turns out that blessings and curses, that prophecies, are subject to interpretation. What does that mean for us? Not only is this a fascinating insight into the biblical perspective on blessings and curses, they are not determinate. We control what they do based on our interpretation of them. We are led not by fate, but by what we choose to do with the gifts that God gives us. It also means that a significant part of our work in this world is to learn how to interpret what God wants from us. God teaches us certain things. The Torah teaches us certain things. It is in our hands to interpret and determine what the best meaning for those things are in our lives.
Thank you, Rabbi Grumman. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.